Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance, go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Greetings from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the May 13th, 2012 edition of Space Talk, live on the air right here on WMMB. Well, thanks for joining us on this Sunday afternoon, and a happy Mother's Day to every mom out there, including my own. And if any of my three grown children are listening right now, you've got about an hour or so before your mom and I get home, and I'm sure she'll be expecting something more than a handmade card you downloaded from the internet. So as my kids scramble to get their mom something, I invite the rest of you to stick around as we talk about, well, launch operations at the Kennedy Space Center and how the team there can do what they do when the actual launch is taking place in the Pacific Ocean. I'll give you a hint. It involves a lot of travel. Well, NASA's Garrett Skrobot and George Diller are here with me in the studio to talk about the upcoming launch of a science probe called New Star, and we'll also touch on a program called CubeSat that gives students a chance to gain first-hand experience with some space science. Your questions and comments welcome as well. Please feel free to give us a call anytime during the program today. Send us an email if you're a little shy about phoning in. No question too dumb, no opinion, not worthy of discussion. Our phone number is 768-1240. The area code is 321 if you need it. And, of course, our email address is spacetalking@aol.com. Well, now we move things along with today's installment of my weekly broadcast blog, Orbital Inclinations. If all goes well, early this coming Saturday morning, well before sunrise, a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket with a Dragon spacecraft on top will launch from Complex 40 at Cape Canaveral Air Force Station on what could be an historic cargo delivery mission to the International Space Station. If all goes well, with an extensive slate of flight test maneuvers conducted early during the mission, NASA will allow the unmanned Dragon capsule to approach very close to the space station and park less than 60 feet from the outpost. If all goes well, crew members inside then will use the station's robot arm to slowly reach out and grab hold of Dragon, carefully berth it to an Earth-facing port located on the Harmony node, check to make sure everything is airtight, and then open up the hatches to enjoy whatever surprises are waiting inside for the astronauts and cosmonauts. If all goes well, those events will mark the first time in history that a privately developed rocket and spacecraft will have pulled off such a feat, which only large government-run programs in the U.S., Russia, Europe, and Japan have been able to do before, if all goes well. Now, this has been part of the plan for our nation's space program for some time now. Our elected leaders have directed that NASA shut down its space shuttle program, continue to utilize the space station as best it can, develop a new rocket and spacecraft to take humans toward the asteroids and Mars, and leave the business of launching cargo and people to and from low Earth orbit to, well, business. If all goes well, the Falcon 9 rocket and Dragon spacecraft will represent the next milestone in the move to rely on a new segment of the commercial space industry for this kind of delivery service, and a lot of eyes are watching this mission very closely. Now, no one that I've seen is actively or openly campaigning for this mission to fail, but there are some folks out there, including members of Congress, who in the event of failure are ready to immediately pounce on the notion that commercial space can do as well or even better than what only the government has been able to do before. Congress already has expressed its distrust and impatience with the new commercial space effort. Just this past Thursday, the U.S. House of Representatives approved NASA's funding for 2013, and in doing so, chopped some $330 million from NASA's budget to assist industry in developing a commercial option for ferrying astronauts to and from the space station. Instead of continuing the healthy competition between companies such as SpaceX and Blue Origin, Sierra Nevada, and others that ultimately would drive down costs and speed development, as the theory goes, the House bill calls for NASA to select a single company as quickly as possible. NASA Administrator Charlie Bolden warned that such a move could double the cost of developing a privately built human spaceflight system and leave the nation in the same situation it is now in, which is having only one option for getting astronauts to the space station. The Senate version of the NASA spending bill already has passed and did not include the same provisions as the House. And President Obama has threatened to veto the measure specifically because of the House action regarding the Commercial Crew Program. All of this sets the stage for the Falcon 9 launch next weekend. And with so much more riding on this mission than an unmanned cargo ship, it must be stressed over and over that this is a test flight. The Falcon 9 has only flown twice before, the Dragon capsule only once, and never in the configuration that it is now in for this flight. History warns us that the chances of a launch or mission failure within the first few tries of any new system is extremely high. The general public, Congress, the White House, and the news media must be ready to accept that failure is a real possibility. And if the worst does happen, the company must be given the chance to determine what went wrong, correct the trouble, and try again. Now, this is not about lowering expectations. This is about raising awareness that spaceflight remains a most difficult and unforgiving enterprise. Whether you're NASA, United Launch Alliance, the Russian Space Agency, Arian Space, or even SpaceX. So we will watch events unfold with patience and anticipation and hope and pray that all will go well. Now, I believe it will. I have a great deal of confidence in the team that Elon Musk has assembled at SpaceX. The people I know who work there are people I have come to admire and respect. They have an attitude and drive to succeed that is on par with some of the best steely-eyed missile men from throughout our space program's history that I've had the honor and privilege of getting to know. With every interview and public appearance, I've become more of a fan of Elon Musk. His vision for what exploring and utilizing space can mean for all of us on Earth rings true to me, and I like his style. Our paths have only crossed a couple of times. Once, many years ago, we sat together on a bus riding through Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. At the time, there was talk, well, rumors really, that SpaceX might be interested in launching from Florida. As we drove by the then recently shut down Launch Complex 36, I pointed it out to him and said, "Someday you could be launching from right there." He replied with a polite, non-committal, "I hope so." But in his eyes, you could see a spark of expectation for dreams of what might be. This upcoming launch and mission from Complex 40, as it turns out, is the next step for SpaceX toward realizing the dreams of its founder and his entire team. It will move our nation's space program in a direction that opens up low Earth orbit to a new kind of commercial development and will allow NASA to better focus its attention on sending humans farther out into space than ever before, if all goes well. And that's this week's Orbital Inclinations. Well, look, when we return from our first break, we're going to start our conversation with some folks from the Kennedy Space Center about an upcoming launch that will take place from the Pacific Ocean. Don't forget the phone lines are open for your questions or comments about anything having to do with our space program. Give us a call at 321-768-1240. Or do send us an email to spacetalking@AOL.com. We'll check that email right now. Please stay tuned. I'm Jim Banky. You're listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com. If it's happening in space, Jim Behnke is there. Okay, well, not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMB.
And welcome back to Space Talk, everyone. Again, 321-768-1240, the number to call to participate in the program today. You can also send us an email all the time at spacetalking@aol.com. Well, next June, if all goes well there too, a small NASA science probe called New Star will be sent into orbit by a winged Pegasus rocket that was launched from the Kwajalein Atoll in the Marshall Islands in the Pacific. And despite the fact the shot is taking place on the other side of the planet, believe it or not, it is a Kennedy Space Center launch team that will be conducting the operation. So how does all that work and what's involved in the whole thing? Well, we're going to learn about some of that with the help of one of the mission's key managers, Garrett Skrobot, who joins us in the studio today. Garrett, welcome to Space Talk.
Well, thanks a lot, Jim, and it's great to be here today to talk a little bit about New Star and some other activities we've been working on. And I'd just like to say, you know, all the mothers out there, happy Mother's Day and have an incredible day.
You're covered. You're covered if you didn't remember your cards or presents. Good. Well, also sitting with us today in the studio, a bonus at no extra charge to you, is none other than my good friend George Diller from NASA Public Affairs at KSC. And still, in my book, one of the best voices of launch control ever, perhaps second only to the great Jack King. And only because Jack got lucky and got to call Apollo 11. Otherwise, he'd be on the top of the list, right? George, welcome.
That's right. Thank you, Jim.
Glad to have you back.
To be on the program once again.
Yeah. So we're sitting here. We're talking about New Star. And Garrett, let's talk to you first. And I'd like to find out kind of what people are, how they're involved in the program. Tell us more specifically about your role in general. And where are you from? And how did you wind up being a space guy like the rest of us?
Well, Jim, it starts back to the 60s when I was raised here in Brevard County.
Oh, really? Where are
you? Yeah, in Cocoa. And I was one of the little space geeks on Earth on the street that listened to the AM radio stations that would broadcast the launches live back then. And
they still do, by the way.
They still do. But the Today newspaper up in the right-hand corner or left-hand corner used to say, next space shot.
Yeah.
And they give you the date, the time, the type of vehicle it would fly on. So I knew exactly which one was going to be. If it was a Delta, we knew the little solids were going to fall off of it.
Sure.
But I would listen to it in my room, and when the launch goes up, I'll be the guy who runs out the street and goes, launch, 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 and all the neighbors would come out and watch the launch with us. That traveled all the way through up through high school and just, you know, enjoyed rocket launches and would watch everyone I could.
Did you have family that worked out here, or were you?
My dad was an electrician, and he was part of the electrical union, and he worked on probably every tower on the center.
Wow.
At one time or another.
So you're second-generation space guy.
Second generation, and I actually had the chance one day to go out on Complex 40 when they had the original tower for one of the Mars missions.
Okay.
And my dad did all the control systems work on the whole tower. And I went out and wished him a happy birthday. And he was so proud that he got up with all the guys around and said, hey, this is my son, the engineer,
That. Cool.
So that was a great day for me.
Well, so born and raised here, you have seen a Saturn V launch.
Yes, I've seen probably all of Saturn V.
Oh, now I'm really envious. So we could just throw the rest of the program away and talk about this. So tell, this is the thing that I want to know. I have my own story of how I've been told a Saturn V looks and sounds compared to a shuttle. But let me hear from you. Tell us, what was it like to watch a Saturn V? What's your memories as a kid watching that thing fly?
Apollo 11, I can remember sitting out in the front yard and in our home, we have those trellis windows on the back door that you roll out.
Okay.
And for some launches, they rattle, but when the Saturn V went up, that whole door started rattling. And we're 30-something miles away.
Yeah.
When the shuttle lifted off, we got a little bit of rattle, but nothing like a Saturn V rumble.
You know, watching a launch from the press side, I am told that the Saturn V, you know, when you watch a shuttle from the press side, and it takes off so quick, and it's gone so fast, the sound doesn't have a chance to really build up. But there is, it builds, and there is this one point where it starts crackling, and you think that, oh, my gosh, if it gets louder just by a little bit more, I'm going to have to do something. I mean, by that point, your clothes are already vibrating.
Yes.
You know, and then you're going to put your hands up to your ears, or you're going to do something. And then, of course, it's moving out of here so fast that it immediately diminishes. People have seen Saturn V launches tell me that if you can imagine it getting to the next level louder and then sustained for like 30 seconds, that's what it was like.
It was an incredible feat to watch those Saturn V, especially 17. It was at night.
So we go from Saturn V now to Pegasus and NuSTAR.
Yes.
Kind of the other end of the size spectrum.
Yeah, NuSTAR is the nuclear spectroscopic telescope array.
Uh-huh.
The instruments are being built in Caltech, JPL, California, and the spacecraft bus is being built by Orbital Spacecraft Division up in Dulles, Virginia. We right now, currently, the spacecraft is actually integrated onto the Pegasus vehicle in Vandenberg.
Okay.
We're getting ready to put the fairings on in a couple weeks and getting ready for the June 13th date. One thing to remember is when we say June 13th, we're talking about continental United States dates, because when we go to Kwajalein, we go over the international dateline.
Oh, really?
So it's actually the 14th in Kwajalein, the day we launch.
Okay.
So it's a little interesting.
So it's tomorrow when it launches?
Yeah, so it'd be the next day.
Okay.
So we could tell you ahead of time what happens.
I was wondering if there was a time paradox there somehow.
So, you know, if you take a look at NuSTAR, it's about 361 kilometers, kilograms.
Kilograms.
About the size of a refrigerator in your house.
Okay.
So that's how we kind of like, you know, look at it as a refrigerator. When NuSTAR gets on orbit, and it's going to be looking at high energy particles, looking at the black holes.
Oh.
To try to look at how the universe was created.
Okay.
And there's information and data in those high energy particles that we can collect. And this will be the first time we will have focusing on it. So we're getting the magnitude, several magnitudes of focusing on our instruments.
So this is a NASA mission. Is it Berkeley, you said, was the school involved? Or?
Caltech.
Caltech, yes.
Caltech.
I'm sorry.
It's a NASA mission out of the Explorers program.
Okay.
And they're funding it. And it's out of Caltech and Goddard Space Flight Center.
Okay, great. George Dillon, let me ask you a little bit about Pegasus. Just give us the rundown. Remind us about what the winged rocket is like. We've seen one or two, anyway, fly from here. At least one that I know of for sure.
Right, and I think we've done two. We processed both the rocket and the spacecraft at KSC. All the rest of them have gone from Vandenberg. They've either actually launched over the Pacific Ocean from
right.
Vandenberg, or we've done them from Kwajalein. And they go from Kwajalein because being that close to the equator, they get to take advantage of the physics of the spinning of the Earth at that low latitude to help get it into orbit. You can carry more payload if you're launching.
You're basically going faster right off the ground in a way.
Exactly.
But you're not going off the ground. Remind us about how Pegasus work with the L-1011.
It flies, it gets deployed from the underside of an L-1011 at about 39,000 feet. It drops for about 5 seconds and then lights off, and away it goes into orbit.
Yeah, a rocket literally with a wing on it to give it some lift. Actually, contributes to the lift in the early
looks
stage.
It's like a flying rocket.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. Stargazer is the name of the L-1011. I don't know if it's the only L-1011 flying in the it can't be the only one in the world flying, but I haven't seen one fly in a long time.
Yeah, Orbital just has one, and that's the L-1011 called the Stargazer.
Yeah, named, by the way, for Captain Picard's first starship. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that.
Actually named for that because the Pegasus was named for Commander Riker's first starship. And so they named it, well, anyway, trivia beyond Robert Perlman next week on Space right. Talk. He and I will outdo each other. So Garrett, you're taking this mission. To what extent, then, is KSC involved in the planning for this thing? I mean, you're providing the launch service, and that's something that you would expect KSC to do. Talk a little bit about the launch services that KSC does.
Yeah, I'm a member of the Launch Services Program, and our key job is to be able to provide launch services for NASA's missions. Robotic missions, science missions. NuSTAR is one of those missions that we went out and procured a launch vehicle for this particular mission, and we managed the whole flow of integration of the spacecraft to the launch vehicle and the actual through the launch campaign and countdown and launch of the vehicle.
So anytime right now that there's a NASA mission launched in an unmanned rocket, is KSC involved in that?
Right now, we have our customers from the other science directorates come to us and say, hey, we have this particular mission. Here's our requirements. Can you go find us a rocket?
So like GOES that we've seen in some of those other big-name missions that have flown on the West Coast and here. And I guess what I'm trying to say is the KSC is still busy launching stuff even though we don't have a space shuttle.
Oh, yes. We're very busy in the science and robotic missions. We got another mission coming up in August, our BSP. We have several missions coming up later in the end of the year, IRIS and LDCM. So
that's another Pegasus at Vandenberg.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's a lot of acronyms there. So
right. And then we'll have two Atlases. We've got the mission launching August 23rd on Atlas V. That's the RBSV.
Which is what?
Oh, my goodness. I have to go back.
A science payload, basically. Yes, a science mission to Earth orbit.
The magnetic fields of the Earth. And then another astrophysics payload in December. Will be another track, a new next generation tracking data relay satellite launched as well in December from here.
Okay.
And then we go back out to Vandenberg in January next year for the Landsat Data Continuity Mission, which is another Landsat-type spacecraft, next-generation spacecraft.
So Pegasus and Atlas, pretty much what's in the manifest right now?
Near-term, right.
Near-term. Yes. Mm-hmm. George, anything with Delta II? Anything sitting out there that you know of?
Well, they're eligible to bid on NASA missions that are coming up. In other words, they on-ramped onto the Launch Services Program contract to be able to bid and compete with the other Launch Services providers. So we don't know, you know, what they're going to compete for yet, but they're able to.
They're able to compete,
so
but nothing.
They may not be out of the picture.
Okay, well, 17's sitting there ready to go. Ariel, we're going to stand by right now, pause for our usual 5-minute built-in hold here at the bottom of the hour, take a break. Get everyone caught up on the latest news, weather, and sports. When we come back, we'll talk more with Garrett Skrobot and George Diller from the Kennedy Space Center. Your call's welcome to 321-768-1240. Email to spacetalking@AOL.com. I'm Jim Behnke. You're listening to Space Talk on the Mother's Day on WMMB.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240. With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Behnke.
And welcome back to our second half of Space Talk on WMMB. Our phone lines and online inbox are open for your contributions to the conversations we're having today about what I think is some very interesting launch operations managed by the Kennedy Space Center. Again, the phone number 768-1240. Email is spacetalking@AOL.com. And with us in the studio, Garrett Skrobot from Launch Services at KSC, the mission manager, is that what we call
correct.
You, of New Star?
Yes, sir.
And George Diller, one of the great voices of launch control from NASA Public Affairs, with us here as well. So, Garrett, we've been teasing the fact that this thing is launching from Kwajalein, and basically the question is, how does the Kennedy Space Center launch a rocket from the other side of the planet?
Well, Kwajalein is a range. It has its own launch facilities there because it supports other government launches. So we just take advantage of this range to be able to take the L-1011 with the Pegasus vehicle on it,
right,
fly it down the Kwajalein. That makes it very unique to be able to fly our own rocket where we want to go,
really,
instead of having a fixed launch structure. And we process it, finish the last few days up on the island, fly it out, get to the drop point, we drop it, and we fly it. So we take the whole team's about 80 people.
Okay.
And told us, and all the launch vehicle side, the Pegasus crew, and the KSC crew as well. And we have everybody on the island there to make a decision for go for launch or stand down and wait for another day if something happens.
Now we were talking about how when the capability of launching from Quaj, a Pegasus launch, once controlled from here, totally from KSC, and then now you're sending a team down there, and you mentioned, I know you just mentioned it, but I want to emphasize the point that the business about making the decision with people on the site, you found that to be an important feature of what you wanted to do.
Yeah, because right now is we have one basic requirement to get voice back to the Mach Center at Berkeley. And so
what's in the Mach is Mission Mach Operations?
Mission Operations Center.
Okay.
And when the spacecraft, that's where the spacecraft will be controlled from. We just have to make sure that center is up and running before we launch the New Star with the Pegasus.
Okay.
Other than that, everything else can be taken care of right there on the island itself. Now, we do have telemetry coming back to Hangar AE, our normal access facilities.
At
Cape Canaveral. And we'll have people there watching it. But if we lose that link or the link goes down, we still can launch the vehicle with the team we have on the island.
And you've got the authority to do that. It's not like your mission managers, your senior people, or your, I don't even know what you're calling them in the unmanned world, but your mission management team.
Our senior management team is on the island with us, and they make the call to go.
So the information coming back to KSC and to the Cape at AE, just kind of an insight, kind of over looking over your shoulders, making sure everything's cool.
Yes.
And George Diller, you're gonna be doing the commentary for this launch. You're seeing all that data. You're not going, I understand. You got to.
That's right. I'll be in Hangar AE, sitting on my usual perch right there. But I've got all of the data, all the visuals, all the graphics, just, you know, as if it were any other launch. It should be transparent to me.
And And that's what's cool, I think. I think that's the neatest thing because, you know, in the old days, you know, we have these rockets that are on gantries and you had to be right there because you could only be as far as the resistance and the copper wire allowed you to be as far away from the rocket. Now with digital, you literally can be anywhere. I mean, it doesn't matter to you whether it's...
And I think that's one of the advantages of Launch Services Program is that we can basically go anywhere to be able to do a launch, whether it's Kwajalein, whether it's Vandenberg, whether it's Alaska, or whether it's here. And we can have the team in place in both places, depending on what the launch is. And so if we have issues, I still have a direct line to the launch director at Kwajalein that I can talk to him and get some direction and get some guidance on how to proceed.
So Kwajalein, Vandenberg, did you do the same kind of thing when you did the Kodiak
we
launch?
Did. Yes. But Garrett was with me.
All those days up there.
Right, I was the integration engineer on that mission.
Enduring the road from the island to the main.
Every day we drove that road.
Oh my gosh! How many tires did you slash through?
I went through two.
Two.
Yeah. I lucked out. I just had one, but there were some that had three or four.
And for our listeners, there is sort of downtown. It's like a single Walmart or something, and then you got to drive all the way out to the launch site, and there's this one road that's essentially lava rock or something like that. I mean, it's extremely sharp, ragged edges.
Yes.
And you can't hardly get through there without getting your tire slashed.
Well, since the Kodiak Star mission, they have paved that road.
Oh, they're trying to compete now.
So it's already paved all the way from town all the way down to the launch complex now.
Wow. Well, that's pretty cool.
Saves on tires.
So you're going to Quad to do this launch. You got some insight here. What's that trip like? I mean, really, how long does it take? Do you hop on a plane at the SLF and go nonstop to the other side of the planet?
Oh, no. We have different legs. The first leg is to Vandenberg.
Yeah.
We go to Vandenberg. We have our flight readiness review.
Because that's where the rocket is now.
That's where the
L-1011's base.
And we'll go and we'll have rollout. We'll attach the Pegasus to the L-1011, get load up everything, and then we'll fly to Hawaii.
Okay.
And we spend the night in Hawaii.
Darn the luck.
And let the crew, you know, check to make sure the vehicle's good, ready to go. And then the next morning we get up, and then we fly into Kwajalein.
And Kwajalein. Marshall Islands, South Pacific, basically.
It's about 9 degrees inclination in the Pacific.
Yeah. So and again, you get that extra spin, that extra boost of the Earth's rotation. To have a smaller rocket like Pegasus able to carry basically a more capable payload. I was going to say not necessarily a larger payload, but certainly a more heavier, capable payload than it otherwise could.
And when that's true, another part of it is New Star has a requirement to have a low inclination.
Okay.
Because they don't want to go through the southern anomaly.
Okay, the South Atlantic anomaly.
South Atlantic anomaly, because they would have to turn the spacecraft off, turn it back on.
Oh.
And being at 9 degrees, they don't have to do that.
Okay.
So they have more observation time.
And so you go over there, you do it, and you basically have a window every day. You're going to be there for the long haul till it goes, or?
Right now we have a primary day and two backups.
Okay.
And our window is basically 4 hours.
Okay.
And we look at the vehicle the spacecraft wants to be in sunlight as much as possible on the first rotation coming off the vehicle so they can charge their batteries.
They can charge their batteries.
Make sure
things
are healthy when they're coming around.
And so one day, two backups, is that a range issue because it's a busy, the Reagan range is busy, or is it just a matter of spacecraft issues?
That's normal. Usually,
normal.
Even on the East Coast and West Coast, you would get a primary day and a backup day.
Right.
If you miss those 2 days, then you would go in and negotiate for the third or fourth, fifth day.
So you're going to just pack for a week and hope for the best.
Yes.
Okay, good. And Garrett, we wanted to make sure we spend some time here before the time gets away because – there's another program that you're involved with called CubeSats. Now, a few weeks ago, we had some incredible high school kids from the Da Vinci Aerospace Academy, Merritt Island High, and one of the things they were involved with and were so excited about was this thing called CubeSats. You're involved in that. You're working with these kids as well. Tell us about what CubeSats are and kind of why you're excited by it.
CubeSats has been around for quite a while. Cal Poly in California and Stanford University started a program about 10, 11 years ago. We got involved in the Launch Services Program back in 2007 where we said, hey, let's go see how we can advance this project by flying these CubeSats on orbit.
Mm-hmm.
They've had a hard time getting on orbit. They were flying on the Russian vehicles. They lost a big one over there trying to find flights. It wasn't a steady base flight base. So we set up what they call a CubeSat Launch Initiative out of headquarters where every August they put a request out for CubeSats, send in proposals. And we have a selection process, and then I get the priority list. It's my job to go launch these CubeSats.
Mm-hmm.
We've launched so far two.
Okay.
We call them Alana, Educational Launch of Nanosatellites.
Okay.
Alana 1 was on the Glory mission. Alana 3, you know, we have Alana 2 coming up. It was out of sync because of the rotation of the vehicles.
Government program.
Yeah, and it was on the MPP mission back in October where we had five CubeSats on that mission that was successfully deployed and they're operational.
How big is a CubeSat?
A CubeSat's roughly about 1 kilogram, and it's about 4 inches square. If you could think of a Beanie Baby box.
Okay.
And you put 2.2 pounds of instruments and science stuff in it. And fly it. That's what we're doing for the university.
That's small. So of course, when we say launching CubeSats, you know, we're not talking about this thing fills the nose cone of a big rocket. These are, I guess, what we've called hitchhiker or secondary payloads. Yeah. If there's a room for them, and you can bolt one on the side of an adapter somewhere and send it on its way.
Well, what we do is we put them in a Peapod, a poly pico orbital deployer system. It's like a jack in a box.
All right.
It's about 16 inches long. And it has a door on it, and then when it gets in the proper, after we release the primary spacecraft, we do a couple of maneuvers, get out of the way, and we open the door, and we there's a big spring in the back that pushes the CubeSats out.
I would imagine there's a range of sophistication, but I was kind of wondering, this CubeSat, this little thing sitting there in Earth orbit, you're able to command it from the ground, communicate with it? Does it send telemetry?
Oh, yes. Right
all
now,
those things.
There's a wide variety of sciences coming from the CubeSats. A lot of them are used for tech demos, testing out new technologies, new components on orbit before they go into a bigger spacecraft. RAX-2 out of University of Michigan is the first CubeSat. It's a 3U. We call them 3 units.
Okay.
Was able to collect space weather data from the Aurora Borealis at the last solar flare from orbit. Now, usually we take these measures from the ground up with radars. We were actually get data from space now. So these CubeSats are actually coming in and showing us real science.
And you know where they're at? I mean, they're big enough, I think, from what I understand about NORAD anyway, at least publicly, that they're about the right size to be tracked. And I guess what I'm wondering is, whatever orbit they're at, they're so small, I bet they don't degrade quick. I mean, I bet you they're going to be up there for a while.
NORAD does track them, and it does depend on the orbit they're in. We do have to meet our guidelines and policies of orbital debris of 25 years, and we meet that for all our CubeSats.
Okay.
So we do that, and we try to find orbits where, you know, they're going to be up there for 2 or 3 years and then come back down and get out of everybody's way.
Got about 30 seconds. Oh, go ahead, George.
The good thing is that they don't necessarily have to be hitchhikers on NASA primary missions. They can be on they could be on Department of Defense missions.
Yes.
They could be on anything.
Anyone that's got room.
Right.
Yeah, willing.
Our next mission, Alana 6, is actually going to be on a DOD mission in August, which has a CubeSat, which has one of the same instruments that RBSP does, one of our primaries.
Oh, really?
And they'll be able to work together and correlate data together.
Oh, my God. Tell us with about 15 seconds real quick, how great are these kids you're working with?
They're excellent. Some of the best kids in the country, actually building spacecraft. As soon as they finish up a project, they can go right into industry and start working on a major project instantly.
They're amazing folks, and it's a great story, and I want to keep an eye on it. Hey, everybody, stand by. We're going to take our final break. When we come back, we'll wrap up our topic of the day, also take a look at our local launch forecast. Again, I'm Jim Bank. You're listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com. Listen to Space Talk on the web at WMMBAM.com.
And welcome back as we do begin our final segment of today's edition of Space Talk. Again, a reminder that you can stay in touch with us throughout the week. If you're on Facebook, just search for our Space Talk with Jim Bankey page. And if you're on Twitter, just look for Space Talking. And as we just mentioned, for one-stop shopping, visit WMMBAM.com, keywords Space Talk. And as we do continue along with the program today, let's pause for a moment and take a look at our weekly look at the local launch forecast. As we did mention earlier, the next launch from Cape Canaveral Air Force Station is the Falcon 9 rocket from SpaceX, which so far remains on schedule to fly this Saturday, May 19th at 4:55 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Now, because this is a launch of the Dragon spacecraft to the International Space Station, there will be what's called an instantaneous launch window, meaning that it will either take off on time that day or not at all. And should there be a weather issue or technical problem of some kind, the SpaceX Falcon 9 team would stand down for a couple of days and try again on May 22nd. There's not much more to say about this other than to once again remind everyone that while there's no denying the importance of this launch to pretty much the nation's entire space program, it is a test flight. Failures do occur, so let's keep our fingers crossed and this team in our prayers during this week. And do stay tuned for WMNB for updates on the countdown and launch, including live coverage Saturday morning. Also this week, I want to mention that that our nation's human spaceflight program is still far from grounded at the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. A U.S. astronaut by the name of Joe Akaba is to launch on a Soyuz rocket with two Russian cosmonauts to the International Space Station tomorrow night, Monday night, at 11:01 p.m. Eastern Daylight. And no, Joe's nickname is not Fruit Loops, for those of you who know what I'm talking about. The trio will join three crew members still on board the orbiting outpost for what is expected to be a six-month stay. The rocket was rolled out to its launch pad this morning, and the word from Baikonur is that everything looks good for an on-time blast-off again tomorrow night, 11:01. And, George, I believe NASA TV is covering that. Did you see that in your memos?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, so you want to tune into your cable channel and watch that coverage from Kazakhstan. For more information about all the various launches scheduled around the world, jump on the web to WMMBAM.com, keyword Space Talk, and look for the link to our launch forecast. Well, we have been talking about KSC launch operations today with George Diller from NASA Public Affairs, Garrett Skrobot, the mission manager for the New Star mission coming up from the Kwajalein Atoll in June. And, gentlemen, I'm not sure which one of you want to take this, but with all the attention on Falcon 9, it's a NASA mission on a commercial launch. To what extent is the KSC Launch Services program involved in this flight?
As far as the SpaceX launch?
Yeah.
Well, for the most part, Garrett, I think it's correct to say they're not.
No, that's true. And I think the data comes in, we may be able to see the data, yeah. And that's
now,
about it.
I think what's significant, though, is that SpaceX will be bidding on future NASA space science payloads under Launch Services Program.
Okay.
So they do have a limited amount of insight into what's going on to get ready for this flight, because they will be flying other things besides just logistics to the space station. They will have space science payloads that they'll be able to bid on along with our other launch service providers.
That's correct.
You know, and there is this public perception reinforced by our broadcast friends in Central Florida that every launch from the Cape is a KSC NASA launch. It doesn't matter who's flying. And, of course, that's not true. But at the same time, because although KSC Launch Service isn't necessarily involved, it is a NASA mission, Mission Control Houston, all that involved. And, George, you're going to be calling the launch.
That's correct. So I think the way we look at this is that, yes, it's a commercial launch, but it's a NASA mission. So just like when we did the GOES launches, GOES, mm-hmm. N-O-N-P, for Goddard and NOAA, those were commercial launches also, but they were NASA missions. So for that reason, we put the launch on NASA TV, and it was a NASA launch broadcast, and this will be much the same way.
Yeah, and, you know, we talk so much about commercial space, and a lot of the general public think commercial space is new. Of course, commercial space is not new when it comes to launches. Commercial launches have been around for a long time. And in fact, leading up to my question, George, I'll never forget – earlier on in both of our careers, when this was all starting, you and I had a long chat in your office once, and you taught me the difference between insight and oversight.
That's correct. The oversight role means that NASA has some direct control. It's a government civil launch. It's not a commercial launch.
Right.
It's not purely a NASA launch, but there's a direct NASA involvement in the launch decision process and in approving the launch to go, in coordination with the launch service contractor, launch service provider. Whereas a commercial launch, we don't have a direct role. It's you deliver the payload to orbit and you get paid.
Right.
So, and so that's the difference there. So there's three flavors of launches. There's the government civil launch, which is what NASA Launch Services Program does. Well, we have a direct role.
Right.
There's a commercial launch, where NASA has insight into what's going on, but no direct control over it.
Right.
And then you also have the Department of Defense launches, which is a completely different flavor of launch
okay.
that we're not involved in.
Right, right. And then, of course, then there's the commercial launch that doesn't involve anyone in government.
At all. And the FAA has the oversight.
And
not
FAA
NASA.
Has the sight.
Correct.
And, of course, doesn't, like we say, no matter what, it's all a NASA launch from KSC. Yeah. Even though that's not right. So... What are you guys thinking about with Falcon 9? I mean, I know we're all wishing it success. Garrett, how hard is this to do, what they're about to do?
You know, launching a rocket's not easy. You know, there's a key thing called rocket, you know, I'm a rocket scientist. Okay?
Right, right.
it's difficult. There's a lot of systems that have to be designed properly and all working together. You know, you're talking, you know, thousands and thousands of parts that all have to work together at one time. Commercially, doing it commercially, yes. You know, the other provider of our launch vehicles, they've been doing it since the 50s. And for these guys to come online and do it in the period of time they have is very impressive.
Yeah.
And the challenge here for SpaceX, I mean, we know the rocket works. We've already had one good commercial launch with SpaceX under the first launch that they did for us. And we were confident enough with that that we have combined the second and third flights into one mission, which is the one that's coming up on Saturday. So the challenge for SpaceX, I mean, the rocket's been ready for a while. The challenge is to have their Dragon capsule have the capability and demonstrate through the software that they can safely rendezvous with the International Space Station.
Yeah, it's just
and then for NASA, that really kicks off what this is all about, is to deliver a combination of experiments, supplies, underwear and socks, food,
CubeSats.
All of that.
Yeah,
right.
CubeSats.
Right.
You know, and we're talking about all this. And gentlemen, thank you very much. We need to start wrapping up, but it is an exciting time in space. We're not dead. As Bob Caban likes to say, we're still open for business. And we truly are. There's so much going on. And thanks for coming in. Still firing the flames. Garrett, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
George Diller, always a pleasure to have you on. Next week on Space Talk, my guest is going to be longtime friend, former colleague at space.com, and fellow space cadet Robert Perlman, one of the few men on this planet who can out-trivia me in any space-related trivia contest. Robert is the soul behind Collect Space website, and he's going to be on with us next week. That is all for now. Space Talk, a production of Mylas Solutions, brought to you thanks to the generous help of supporting sponsors Space Florida, Boeing, Abacus Technologies, SpaceX, United Launch Alliance, and Lockheed Martin. My thanks to Sean Williams for manning the op station for today's program. We're going to be together on Saturday morning for the launch coverage of the SpaceX Falcon 9. Don't miss it, about 4:55. Join us next Sunday at 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight for another live hour of Space Talk. And right now on WMMB, a weekend edition of the Best of Bill Mick Live. I'm Jim Behnke. We'll talk to you again real soon, and happy Mother's Day to everybody.